our session before lunch is on financial reporting. So while the panel comes up, I suppose I still remember the days when I was dealing with what was then ED4. And at that point, it was called the Creation of Employment for Actuaries and Accountants Bill. So just by show of hands, who at the moment is directly involved in IFRS 17 work in terms of the guys in the room? Okay, I assume you guys are, but I hope you are. Okay, so it's about 15-20% odd. Okay, so I suspect not as much creation of employment yet. What we want to discuss today is not the ins and outs of the standard. I think we've had a lot of presentations all the way through the last couple of years in terms of what this thing called the CSM is, what it looks like. So what we rather did was just to get a panel of people together, some industry, some consulting, and to have a look at what the state of the readiness is and what the challenge is being faced. Some simple numbers. It was 1 year to the day next Friday that the IFRS 17 standard was published, and there are less than 1,000 days to implement it. So you're about a quarter of the way through your timeline. I hope you're ready for what you've got to do. But just quickly, just as a reminder, seeing as not everyone's involved in it, just a reminder of what it is. It's the new reporting standard for financial contracts that the ISB has put in place. Other terminology that you may have remembered in years back would be IFRS 4 Phase 2, and it's to standardize the insurance accounting for insurance contracts to create a single unifying model across the world, other than those territories like America that have opted out of being part of the world. But they do have the World Series. It covers predominantly, and this is why we get involved as heavily as we do, it covers the methodology for calculating liabilities and then the subsequent measurement of those liabilities and then working out what of those goes into the income statement. Importantly, and I usually say this when I talk to clients and audiences like this, the word actuarial, does not appear in the standard. Okay, so it's an accounting standard, but however, the methodologies are of such an actuarial nature that we are critically involved in the production of the numbers. As I say, the objective is to produce relevant statements, and we'll ask the question of the panel now in terms of whether they think it's going to achieve that, to make sure that the financial performance of insurance, of entities that write insurance contracts, can be compared. And the important key steps in it are to make sure that there's a common understanding of what is an insurance contract, that there's some element that limits the amount of cross-subsidy that exists between contracts when reporting them, and then making sure that the balance sheet impact of the insurance contracts is recorded correctly, and therefore the income statement impact is recorded correctly as the standard goes forward in time. I think somewhere in our processes, I think there are some clients that are still in denial. Some people feel they are being stuffed, and then we are somewhere in between. So, panel today, so it's on my left, Ronaldo de Gabella is the IFRS 17 program lead in Liberty. He spent some time in a consultancy as well, so has cut his teeth in both consulting and industry, and is now responsible on the industry side for implementing IFRS 17 for Liberty. Tracy is the... as an actuarial consultant with QED, actuaries and consultants, also now responsible for their IFRS 17 program. And she said earlier this morning, she is the chief cook, bottle washer, and everything else in respect of IFRS 17 for QED, but focusing on both South African and African clients. So I think there's some specific challenges for countries outside of South Africa in terms of implementation. Jack Niemand is an actuary at MMI. And he actually resides in Cape Town, so thanks for coming up. I know you were presenting IFRS 17 to your actuarial committee on Tuesday, and so well experienced in that. He also was very involved in the Solvency II and SAM work in MMI. Michael Meerkotter, senior manager at EY, also very involved in the life insurance side and obviously involved in the IFRS 17 space. So I'm going to kick off from current state, and I suppose the best place to start is the last 6 years of our lives, and that's the implementation of SAM. And so I'll start with Jack. And in terms of product classification, which I talked to, is the first step that's important. Given that we've gone through product classification exercises for SAM, particularly things like contract boundaries, how much commonality is there and isn't there, and what are you finding in terms of having to look at it differently and potentially recalibrate some of the elements of your models from a particularly, I think, contract boundary perspective, given the classification is not so much of an issue for SAM?
Yeah, I think so on contract boundaries, I think a lot of the thinking around what is a contract boundary has really been helped by SAM. So I think just introducing the concept and helping people to understand what is meant by a contract boundary and what is meant by a contract, I think that's sort of the extent to which SAM was helpful. Unfortunately, SAM is a solvency regulation. And in that case, you're looking at cash flows across the balance sheet. Whereas IFRS 17 is quite specific on measuring and valuing contract by contract. So the most significant challenge we're faced with at the moment is sort of changes to unbundling in terms of what components are grouped together and may not be grouped together or may not be separated. And so I think that would be different to SAM. I do think that's sort of that's probably an area of focus on product classification, and SAM's not going to help you there. Mm.
So if then we look at it, having looked at those contracts, Ronaldo, the SAM models have been built, as I say, we had 6 years to have a seriously good look at our models, make sure we were doing best estimate cash flows in the models. Mm-hmm. And as Jacques points out, SAM is there to make sure that, you know, that's a balance sheet balance sheet measurement mechanism to say, are you going to be around over the next 20 years, as opposed to IFRS, which is saying, how much have you earned over the next 20 years? What are the three or four key differences that you're finding between your SAM modeling environment that you've got and the modeling that you're doing, and what IFRS 17 is actually asking us to do?
Okay, so I think, if you break it up, if you look at the different elements, you've obviously got your best estimate liability, your risk adjustment, and then your CSM. So we look at it in those three buckets. From a best estimate liability, I'd say that the two key differences are around expenses. So I think directly attributable is a phrase which, you know, sends shivers down people's spine in the room, just because I don't think we've really grappled with what exactly that means or necessarily got stuck into the detail of how we're going to model that. So in the SAM world, you'd potentially model all of it, whereas now we're only allowed to model the directly attributable expenses. So I think that's quite a key difference that we are working through. The other big key difference is around reinsurance. So I think within SAM, your reinsurance contract boundary and even the way that you would model reinsurance would very much follow the underlying contract, whereas in IFRS 17, it has to be seen as an entirely separate contract, which may mean that it has a different contract boundary to the underlying contract that the reinsurance is covering, and obviously that can cause issues. And then secondly, I think the big difference is around this notion of potentially, depending on the contractual agreements of your reinsurance arrangement, of needing to model the future expected future new business of your underlying reinsurance contract, which is not something that historically we've done before. I think if you then move on to the risk adjustment, conceptually, you know, is it in line with the risk margin in SAM? There's a lot of different approaches, but I guess that's also something where companies are going to have to decide, do we want to align it with our SAM risk margin methodology, or do we want to potentially move to something different? So there's also a little complexities around there. And then in terms of the contractual service margin, obviously something new which isn't in SAM, but I think the main sort of difference there. Coming up with your CSM at day naught is pretty straightforward, but there's a lot of discussion around the coverage units and how exactly are we going to earn the CSM over the contract lifetime. So I know there's been lots of discussions internationally, debates about even potentially changing elements of the standard, but I think that's a key area where at least us as insurers have been looking at the possible different options, and that's obviously going to be quite different to SAM.
Okay. And Michael, on something like transition, so one of the key things that needs to happen is that the opening balance sheet effectively reshapes the entire insurance balance sheet and you push that through equity. How much of the existing modeling environment can and can't be used given the methods that are allowed, the approximations that are needed, and the fact that you need data back to, let's call it 1960, to find that one poor policyholder who still has the old generation product on the balance sheet?
So I think the sort of the key part of the standard is around undue cost and effort. If we look through Appendix C, which is if we break it up, Part A sort of sets the scene, Part B sends more shivers, Part C sort of gets people crying. And, you know, obviously as we start looking at the full retrospective approach, effectively it says, you know, if you've got the wherewithal and you can make use of your existing modeling environment, and obviously undue cost and effort, sufficient data, et cetera, then you can start making use of this. Then sort of moving down the line, you've then got the choice between modified retrospective and transition. And obviously the sort of the key place that we then enter into approximations is really around modified retrospective. And the ultimate goal there is to get as close to the full retrospective approach as possible. Now, in terms of the current modeling environment, that's obviously quite a deviation. Where there is sort of more of a syncing up with the current modeling environment is tying in with what they call the earliest date. So working from that point forwards and then applying the approximations around that point in retrospectively. And there are a number of simplifying criteria that the standard, or I guess the ISAB has allowed us to make use of in achieving that. And then coming lastly to the fair value, that's obviously a dramatic simplification of the actual environment. And that really leverages most of all of the existing sort of modeling environment that would be in place come 2021.
Great, thanks. So we've got some, I suppose, we've got some tools to work with, and I think the benefit of having SAM as an existing chassis on which to build is highly advantageous. We do know that some other countries that are only moving into a solvency type regime are having some big leaps to go from the old net premium valuation methodology straight into this is going to hurt a lot. But I suppose you've got that from what we have got. And I know that the statements that have been made over time is that what we're going to find is that the actuaries and the accountants are going to start working together and everyone's going to be singing Kumbaya every financial reporting period. So it's early days in the journey. And Tracy, you're sort of coming in particularly into clients where you aren't in a bigger sort of accounting framework. How are you finding that truism of you're going to have to play with the finance guys more eloquently panning out?
It's definitely it's been a learning curve. As I said, I am in an actuarial only firm, so I have the extra pressure that I have had to learn to speak accounting so that I can communicate. But I'm finding it, even with all the training sessions that we are doing with clients in the workshops, as we start interacting, your financial statements are moving so much into more of an analysis of surplus type world where it's expected claims and experience adjustments, we're finding that we are needing to learn to speak each other's language a lot more. So I don't think at this stage, I think it's probably too early to tell if companies are going to be changing their team structures and how those your financial statement teams actually look going forward. But I do think that's going to be driven in a large way by how you choose to house your system. So are you going to have more of the contractual service margin sitting at that group of insurance accounting level? Is that going to be sitting on your accounting ledger, or are you going to be sitting it more in actuarial systems? Who owns those systems? That's going to dictate how much each party needs to learn each other's language and how your teams are going to have to be structured. But definitely you cannot get away with what we've had before, where we only look at the liability as an actuary and it's like, well, there you go, accountants, here you go, here's my number, go do what you do best. That no longer can apply. Your financial, if you're going to understand your financial statements, both your finance team and your senior management now actually need to really start understanding these concepts of analysis of surplus and what's actually going on to be able to have any idea as to how their balance sheet and their income statement is going to progress going forward.
So Jack, how are you finding that at the coalface when you're looking at your programs? How many people have you got from the actual community and how many from the finance community are in that hot box of trying to work out how to solve this problem, probably what the problem is, how to solve it, and how to run the business going forward?
So at the moment, we're probably about 70% actuarial, and then the remainder mainly being finance, and IT only as and when needed.
Well, because actuaries can just build everything they need to.
Not really. I think it's important to start at a point. You know, I think if I was telling a colleague of mine the other day, if we look at the challenge ahead, you'll just sort of keel over. You know, it's just too big to look at. So you've got to take steps. So we take steps in the area that we know we can progress on, and progress in the right direction. And once we've progressed, then we take, you know, then we take more people along. I think where it would end up, I think it's probably also that type of mix. If you think about who's involved in the production of financial reports, I do think you'll end up with a multidisciplinary team involved in financial reporting.
So Ronaldo, you know, you're looking at it also from a corporate perspective, and we've got, you know, so the community here has got the modeling environment. We've done a whole lot of work in SAM. We've walked towards a lot of the elements of the problem. If you look at the finance reporting community that you interact with, how are they responding to, let's say, walk towards their problem, and suppose they're concerned that the actuaries are taking over the income statement, but at the same time, are they walking towards the problem, say, well, we want to own the CSM, to point to Tracy's point of where it might end up? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think even just to add on to the first couple of points, I mean, I'm still a little bit wary that actually the IASB has just introduced IFRS 17 to get actuaries and accountants to talk to one another. And once that's done, they'll just can the whole thing, just to prove that we can actually work together.
That's why it took so long.
Yeah, but so I think I wouldn't say that necessarily from a finance side they're holding on to what they've had before. I think at the end of the day, like everyone's pointed out, you know, your income statement is moving more to call it analysis or surplus type view. And I think the reality is you've got to look at it and say, you know, who's best skilled to unpack this. What it might mean is that there'll be a lot more actuaries involved in the financial reporting space going forward. And that's just the reality that we all are going to have to face. And there's certain upskilling that we are going to have to do in order to be able to move into that world.
So if you look at that, Michael, are we ready, I suppose, you know, are we ready to dust off our accounts 101 to do the necessary work that we need to do to provide what the FD wants as opposed to what the regulator wants?
Yeah, I think it's a necessity, actually. If we look at what we actually now are required to do, I mean, realistically, the actuaries now effectively own the top half of the income statement. And to be able to communicate that across appropriately, we actually do need to be able to speak accounting fluently. I mean, in a previous life, I worked in a CFO capacity, and the ability to speak both languages makes for a dramatically easier conversation when you're going to speak to an FD that tends, by and large, to come from an accounting-specific background. And I think this is also within the evolution of the actuary. We're no longer living in sort of our dedicated silos looking at things, and the more integrated we get into businesses, the better the conversations we can have and the bigger the impact we can have.
So, and I'll open this to anyone in terms of closing the section on the skills that actuaries need, is where are we right now in terms of being able to communicate to the CFO what it is going to mean for him, both from his process perspective, his controlling perspective, and his results perspective. So have we got a clear steer of what things like return on equity and earnings growth are going to look like, or are we still a bit of a way off in terms of what we've got in the remaining 1,000 days? So I'll throw it at Yuck first, because he's in that space.
I think the simple answer is no. But if I have to say more than that, I think the journey is, just thinking about Michael's point as well, there's also not just the evolution of actuaries and accountants in financial reporting, there's also the evolution of management and the FD and who is responsible there. So I think that engagement, the earlier you can get that, to sort of have them almost grappling with the same challenges that you are, the earlier you get that, the better. In terms of where we are in our program, in terms of those, almost, let's say, more strategic challenges, I wouldn't say we're scratching the surface, but we've definitely got some way to go to unpack, where we ultimately want to end up in June 2020. Mm-hmm. When we're taking on those balances. So I wouldn't say we're in a position where we'll sort of communicate those sort of balances. If anything, it'll be ranges, given the different type of options that are available to you.
Tracy, your experience?
My experience is that most of the smaller companies have not even started. So they're still grappling with, oh yeah, we've got this IFRS 17. Okay, what does it actually say? So we are right at the basics with many of your junior clients. I mean, they've just got, in the South African clients, are like, right, we've just done SAM. Really? What's this IFRS 17 all about? And I mean, if you go, I mean, I'm not sure if your question's coming later, but I mean, going into Africa, they're even further behind. So we're still having to train on what is a reserve, let alone, and that basic concept is not really there in many of the management world, and the stakeholders don't even understand that concept. So now having to now retrain even your accountants on this income statement and balance sheet, it's going to be a massive journey.
So I think some observations have always been presenting the income statement. So for those who haven't been unfamiliar with it, the top line of the income statement of an insurance company is going to have release of this contractual service margin, which is a modelling item, the release of your risk adjustment, which think about as a reduction in your risk margin in SAM world, your expected claims and your expected expenses, i.e. stuff that you've pulled out of your modelling environment. That's your revenue line of your income of your insurance company. At which point the finance guy looks at it and goes, well, where are my numbers? And you go, well, your numbers come later. And that's the bit where they sort of lose it a bit, that they realize that they don't know enough about what actually is embedded in the products that they write, because they're constructing their teams and their views on what premiums am I paying, what premiums am I receiving, what claims am I paying, and how many assets have I got in terms of the transition. So there's this big, you know, transition from that product orientation. So there's a whole lot of costs being incurred now, and a whole, yeah, sorry, yeah, go.
Sorry, I just want to give one more point in on the skills.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe a place where Sam sort of pushed us in the opposite direction, was not helping, in that we've got a whole generation of actuaries who've now sort of grown up with prospective models and everything is a discounted cash flow, and, you know, whereas the CSM is actually harks back to much earlier actuarial practice or North American methods, those type of things which people just don't use anymore. So I do think, in terms of actuarial people and finance people involved in IFRS 17, I think just maybe getting that mental shift that you're dealing with an animal that's not a traditional actuarial reserve in what people have learned over the past couple of years, I think that's that'll be a challenge. That is a challenge.
So when you finish this, I'll bring Mr. Trans and Mr. War into the conversation around US GAAP, because there's some interesting observations that they've made to me over the last year. So we've now got a whole lot of costs being incurred. We're starting to see some costs coming through from a build perspective, and we're going to have to reconfigure our finance teams. Are we going to see the benefits that IFRS 17 is promising in terms of this better clarity, better consistency, and potentially better granularity of information? Ronaldo, from your perspective, in terms of what you're seeing, what you're hearing, and what you feel.
Yes, I think consistency across companies. I mean, I know there's a lot of optionality within IFRS 17, or I say a lot. There's some optionality, and I think that leads people to think that, okay, well, that means that it's not going to be consistent. But the reality is it's going to result in a lot more consistency than currently exists under IFRS 4. So, you know, the mere notion of having to set up a CSM, how you roll forward that CSM, yes, how you earn it, there might be some flex, but the reality is that it's definitely going to bring companies closer together. I think where the benefit will more come from is actually internally. So the consistency between your solvency basis and your actual regulatory reporting basis, to the extent that those are aligned, maybe not exactly, but at least from a communication perspective up to your board, I think it'll be a lot easier than historically we've had, where we've had, you know, EV, current financial reporting, car. It's just been a little bit all over the place, and at least with it being a little bit more aligned, it should be an easier message up to the board.
So, yeah, do you see this as the demise of EV?
No.
And why not? Sorry, I've put exam questions. It's only one mark, and you can see one mark, yeah. Mark question.
No, so that explains many things as far as my exam results are concerned. So I think the obvious answer is on contract boundaries. That if you're 17 contracts, you know,
grab the mic.
If you're 17 contracts wouldn't necessarily help us with sort of placing in an embedded value on contracts with short boundaries. I think there's another piece here, and that's on in product development. When we're looking at VNB and product value over its life cycle, that FS17 is a useful tool, but it can't be the only tool. So that's sort of where on which I base my current view to say no. To the extent that EV becomes an internal measure as opposed to an externally published measure, I think that's probably a slightly different question. There might definitely be a move to sort of less prominence in external reporting of embedded value.
So you're still going to land up with additional metrics that you have to reconcile and the cost of producing those. But Michael, will the disclosures around IFRS 17, so if you think about the fact that you've got some optionality but a whole lot of disclosures around IFRS 17, do you think that there's enough information in that can differentiate? So for example, the risk adjustment, you've got one line in the standard that says that you have to have one of these things and then you have to do a calibration and disclose on it. Is there enough information in that to then unwind the optionality, as Ronald was pointing out in the standard, or is that just going to create more complexity for analysts to try and unpack?
I don't think, I mean, if we look at what's sort of the mandatory disclosures that are coming out of IFRS 17, I mean, there is some disclosure around the methodologies that you've used for your discount rate. So in some places, yes. In other places, no. I mean, if we use the risk adjustment as a specific answer, sort of example of something for comparability, the one area that the standard forces comparability is to show what the confidence interval is, or the confidence level around that that risk adjustment. So effectively, regardless of the method, you are disclosing what that extra risk that you're adding on is. So is it a perfect disclosure of where the difference arises? Definitely not, but it does give some indication. So I think from an analyst point of view, there will still be a lot of questions. Will the future financial statements and disclosures give more insight? Probably. I mean, if we look at the current sort of, the major analysts in South Africa, there's a lot of focus on EV. I think there will still be additional reporting requirements around, if we're going to equate EV to CSM, there'll probably need to be more information around, how are these changes in the CSM being composed, what's driving them. So I think if we take the vanilla statements that the standard's pushing forwards, there will probably need to be more put forwards, at least from an analyst's point of view, to understand exactly what's going on.
Okay. So we've got a picture there that there's work being done. I think still a whole lot of understanding needs to come through. Tracy, in her wisdom, put her hand up for what will be my last question to the panel before we open to the floor. And that's a big, bold question that says, what are the emerging big challenges with IFRS 17, particularly if we look at the context of a global standard being deployed into massive multinational insurers? And I discovered earlier last month, actually, that European insurers can opt out of IFRS and go to their local GAAP. So small European insurers and certain UK insurers aren't going to even adopt this. But where you've got territories that universally adopt IFRS as their local GAAP, you now are stuck in that space. So, Tracy, you were saying earlier that you've got clients that products don't support the current management structure and the cash-based accounting. What are you finding, and how do you think we're going to help clients solve those challenges?
I think the biggest thing that we're seeing, especially in our consultancy, is like, is there an IFRS light? We really want to comply, but we need to do so at lower cost as possible. And especially in going in like the small companies or going into Africa where that skill level is just not there and that understanding this level is just not there, how can you translate the huge complexity of what is required to what is actually necessary to make sure that your financial statements make sense? And that for me is the biggest challenge, is how do you, can you come up with even like a risk adjustment and express it as a percentage and come down to something that is meaningful, meets the intention that will communicate to users of financial statements, communicate to them what needs to be communicated, but at the same time actually give something that is practically useful, given that there won't be information, there aren't the data systems, there isn't that sophistication in the market. And I think so it's for us, mostly Africa is driven by, and your smaller insurers is driven by consultants. So I think it's going to be up very much to the consultants to come up with something that works and is practical to apply.
And actually, inside programs at the moment, Jack, Ronaldo, what, if you sort of have to label, what is the big thing that, you know, keeps you awake at night, other than all the other big things? What would you put on the list? Ronaldo first.
Yeah, well, the other night, my wife said that I woke up saying CSM in my sleep, so that's probably point number one. No, I think the main thing is really just around that data management and data storage. Not necessarily the storage of it, but I guess because of what the CSM forces you to do, it's just about how you're going to go and track it through the lifetime, how you're then going to feed that through into your financial reporting. And I think it's not something that historically we've had to do as an insurance company. I mean, we've had to worry about one line item, in essence. But now having to sort of track all of those different CSM groups in the way that the standard wants you to, I think that's probably some of the biggest challenges that insurers are facing at the moment. And coming up with the technology, the solutions around that is going to be key.
Yeah,
over the tea time, Nicholas reminded me that the accounting policy choices we make now and what we do for transition will probably live with us for the rest of, well, my lifetime. So that's quite scary. And in a way, you can be measured on to what extent you'd need to change that in the future, or to what extent that's not really working out as a useful measurement approach. So I think that just sort of raises the stakes. Maybe just sort of tying on to that is just the breadth of what we need to tackle in this, because it's, you know, I think that we start off with our focus of being financial reporting, getting it right into financial statements. But you know, if we think about product development and strategic choices, there's quite a lot of breadth across insurance company that where people actually really need to understand quite well, you know, what do we mean by a coverage unit, and how, and the service cost. What do you use the risk adjustment for? I mean, Michael, you alluded to sort of future profit speaking to the CSM, but it's actually the CSM plus the risk adjustment, and just that market perception of what do you put in the risk adjustment. You know, there's all those type of things. So there are many things that keep me away.
Great. So we've got a few minutes. I want to throw it open to the floor. I know it was Ronaldo made the comment to me that he's going to redirect questions straight to me, but please direct comments to the panel. And yeah, I'm interested to hear your views if you have any around that. And I invite, as I say, Giles and Paul, because I think there's some interesting observations from the parallels of US GAAP that we haven't lived under. That when we engage with clients who do report under US GAAP, they come up with a very different view of what this is and how they see it from a problem perspective. So, invoke my rights as chair.
Yeah, before I respond to that, I'd like to. I'm also on the board of Old Mutual Kenya, and my frustration is that the financial guys there haven't got a clue. And I think somebody mentioned that. I think you mentioned don't actually know what drives the profit, you know, what are the profit drivers. I always made the point of getting the actuary to first give us his actual report on the net surplus, why we made a loss, persisting losses, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then I say to the accountant, now don't try and explain where profits come from. Just tell us, you know, premiums, assets, whatever. And I'm looking forward to a stage where you have one reporting that, in fact, even if it will be the actuary will be doing the reporting for many, many years, there won't be this funny IFRS income statement that you then have to try and explain to the lay directors. Ignore that. What they actually said was the important thing. Just listen to the actuary. Don't listen to the accountant. You have to do it politely, of course. But at the end of the day, because you know, if an accountant who doesn't understand where reserves come from and you've got it exactly nailed in the head, he can't explain the outcome. He'll just say the increase in actual reserves are more than yet last year. Well, you know, 20% more than last year, and that's the explanation. That's it. But coming to US GAAP, so another question is, what is going to happen to second-tier margins in this territory? You know, we're the only country in the world that has allowed discretionary second-tier margins to enter into our accounting basis. You know, it goes against all principles of accounting standards, and we were able to let it in 20 years ago, whatever. Have people started thinking what they're going to do with their favorite second-tier margins? Are you going to try and get it in there somehow or other as well?
Can I jump in there? So I can't. I think that's probably a little bit too close to proprietary information in terms of what we'll do with second-tier margins exactly. In principle, you can say that they'll disappear. But there's an interesting question, for example, on the risk adjustment.
why did you have a second to margins to start off with? I'm not talking about zeroization here and there or just an actuary sum. We've got a real reason to have a second tier margin is because you believe there's some underlying risk there. And for me, there's ample room in the standard to incorporate that in the risk adjustment, just as an example. First tier and second tier margins, as we currently know them today, probably disappear, just be replaced by the risk adjustment and the CSM. The risk adjustment is a lot more discretion, your own view. CSM is much more mechanical.
Question in the back there?
Quick one for you guys, or hopefully a quick one. You talked about how there are some small and maybe medium insurers who haven't gotten started with IFRS 17. If I were hypothetically to find myself in a situation like that... And we're about to be going in and pitching in terms of project size, resources, support. What sort of message would you be going in with? And thinking about the experience that we had in the UK with Solvency II out here with Sam, where people vastly overestimated in some cases and vastly underestimated in some cases. Any insights and guidance you can give, I think, would be appreciated, hypothetically.
So which of the three of us are running first? So Tracy, go for it.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the short order is, consultants are obviously ahead of the game, so hence, which of the first one, three of us are running first. But yeah, I think, I mean, every consultancy does things differently, but it's probably is the quick way of fast-forwarding at a relatively cheaper cost is just figure out for us, I'm speaking with my QED hat, I mean, our first few steps are understand the standard and understand the impact on your system so that you at least know where your gaps are to say, okay, this is what it actually means for all of our products, classify your products, where does it actually go, to what extent are we ready, are we not ready, where are those gaps, are our systems suitable to be able to plug those holes with just getting a few programmers in, can we solve it, or do we actually need to find another solution and what is out there? So the sooner you've at least done that step, understanding where you are, what you need to do, you can then move yourself forward from there. So for us, our thing is always just get yourself to that point as quickly as possible to maximize the amount of time that you have to minimize that cost of implementation because you've got a bit longer and you're not needing to scramble and suddenly pay exorbitant prices because no one's available to help you or suddenly get resources. Had you just taken a little bit longer and to plan, you could have used your own internal resources and planned it over time without having to incur extra cost to scramble to get over the line at the implementation date.
Yeah, I think just building on Tracy's earlier point, I think one of the key things that we as the actual community need to do, given that we're owning a space that doesn't have our name attached to it, is learn how to speak accounting again. So if I look at it, we did most of us did at least 1 year of accounting, some probably did more. The accountants we're dealing with have never done product modeling. So the gap to bridge for them is to actually learn the product and the model and projections and cash flows and discounting. Where our bridge is to dust off our accounts 101 notes. And having done that, you get a lot more credibility with the accounting community to say, okay, we actually have a role to play here, as opposed to, well, this is actually my standard, and how do I actually, how do I own it? So it's also that ability to get access into the accounting space and understand it in their frameworks.
Hi, thanks, Andrew. So I've just got a couple of questions. So the first one is, obviously there's a lot of ambiguity in the standard, and I mean, I think you guys have touched on that. Some of that ambiguity is deliberate. I mean, the standard deliberately mentions that, and some of it maybe is not so deliberate. Maybe from the consulting side, are you currently seeing big differences in interpretation, and maybe what areas are you seeing big differences in interpretation? And do you expect convergence over time, or do you expect... do you expect analysts to be happy with differences as long as they're disclosed? So that's my first question. My second question is, so I mean, you potentially be getting to the stage now where we're beginning to discuss some of the impacts with the impact of IFRS 17 with boards and things like that. And I mean, Ronaldo touched on it, the risk of the ISB changing the standard. Is that a real risk in your opinion? And if there are to be changes, do you think, or where do you think that those changes would come through?
I'll throw it to Michael.
So I think in terms of the interpretation aspects, and as you say, sort of the deliberate and inadvertent ambiguity, there's, particularly with the TRG panel that's now running in the UK, obviously, you know, there's the major insurers from the world, obviously the big four sitting there. So these are sort of some of the key topics that are being brought up by industry and the big four for discussion. And that is sort of driving some convergence. So to use a bit of an extreme example, I mean, there was a lot of discussion around coverage units. Mm-hmm. And the ISAB staff have come out and said, you know, you'll use maximum cover. That hasn't taken away the discussion, but it's definitely given some very direct sort of interpretation. I mean, there obviously are some more nuanced items, but and without getting into proprietary sort of information, you know, every business will have its own nuanced items that it needs to deal with. And when tackling those within the standard, you know, dealing with auditors, dealing with consultants, to go sort of through the exercise of understanding, you know, does our interpretation match what you're seeing in the market, and B, sort of your engagements with the ISAB? So, yes, there is still sort of this, I don't even call it nebulous, but the universe of items that are still out for sort of distinct interpretation are narrowing quite quickly. And I think that's also vital for all of us in terms of actually getting forward with our plans and implementing.
Yeah, I think I was also going to highlight just that the TRG is bringing a lot of convergence in terms of thinking. And I think, I mean, we've had two meetings now, and I think just listening in on the talks, if you can, I mean, they can be quite painful, but if you can put aside the day, I think the next one they're talking about 2 days because there's so much to discuss, and just they prepare the papers ahead of time. You can actually sign up for free. It's a webinar. You can just listen in, and it does actually, all the past papers and the summaries do help direct in trying to figure out, because sometimes, I mean, you read the standard. It is written by accountants, but needs to be understood by actuaries, and that's, I mean, I'm still learning new things just by attending the TRG, and it's like, is that what they meant? And it's then sort of like, and then things start clicking into practice. So that would be some advice, sort of like, look, if you have the time, set aside that read those papers, they do direct, and aim you in the better direction as to what's actually intended and not what we think is intended.
So we could sit here all afternoon and regale you on IFRS 17 down to the nth degree of detail, but I think you guys are wanting lunch. I think we've had a good 3 sessions up to now. So first of all, thanks very much to my panel. I strong-armed them in, and I think they did a wonderful job. Thanks very much. So lunch is now served outside. If you do want to sit down, there are chairs and tables on the terrace. The soft drinks of the society's accounts, and please remember during that time to swap your parking tickets with Melanie. We will reconvene. I will steal back the 5 minutes that Niklas gave you. We'll reconvene at 1:15. The future of insurance will be in here, Peter Temple's discussion on the future of insurance, and the PHI topic will be next door, rooms 1, 2, and 3. So once again, thanks very much, guys, and have a good lunch.